Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and podcast on Radio Free Nashville 107.1 and 103.7 and streaming live at radiofreenashville.org.
And this is based on our, you know, annual nuclear war games called Global Thunder, and we do it every year. And we found a statement by General John Hyten, who was the commander of the U.S. Strategic Command at the time, talking about these exercises. And you know, I had given up trying to find out anything about them, because if you Google Global Thunder, you will see every year the Pentagon's PR statement, and that's all you see. There's no independent analysis or investigation of these exercises. So anyway, John Hyten gave an address to the Arms Control Association 2018, not too long after one of their annual Global Thunder exercises. And what he said is, you cannot prevent escalation once you have a nuclear weapon that has been used. And he said, we've tried, you know, every year, we've run all these war games and simulations, and he said, and it ends the same way every time. It ends bad.
That was Harvey, and today we're going to start our discussion on how you can talk to your neighbors or give a presentation to a group on the clear and present danger of nuclear weapons. But first, my name is Jim Wolgemuth, and I am here with fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. We're members of Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org. This radio show and podcast is on stations across the country. Thanks to the Pacifica Radio Network, we're also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcasts, Spotify, and your phone podcast app. Just search Veterans for Peace. We also have an important announcement. The Golden Rule, the Veterans for Peace sailboat, might be coming to a waterway near you if you are on the Mississippi, the Gulf of Mexico, the East Coast, or various waterways in the North. The Golden Rule's Great Loop is starting in Minnesota, bringing a message of peace and hope. For more information and to donate so we can actually make this happen, go to Veterans for Peace Golden Rule Project.org. That is VFP Golden Rule Project, all one word, .org. Okay, so while the mainstream media, YouTube, Twitter, and other platforms are censoring voices of activism and dissent, we will continue to share those voices who stand up against the establishment, who stand up against the military, industrial, congressional, media, corporate complex, who stand up for us, the global us. So Harvey, before we get into the meat of the show, what I want to do is I want to talk about the latest betrayal with regard to the Congress and especially the Republicans when it comes to veterans care, because they a bunch of them flipped their votes with regard to the PACT Act. Now, Mary said, hey, what's the PACT Act? What's the PACT Act? I had no idea. I didn't know that it was going by that acronym, but then I found out that it is the Promise to Address Comprehensive Toxics PACT, and it's the act that was passed a month ago by the Senate, 84-14, which would, and if you don't mind me saying, Harvey, here we go, expand VA health care eligibility to post 9/11 combat vets, which is estimated to be include more than 5 million toxics exposed, create a framework for the establishment of future presumptions of service connection related to toxic exposure, add 23 burn pit and toxic exposure related conditions to the VA's list, expand presumptions related to Agent Orange to exposure to include Thailand. I know I had a lot of friends that were in the Air Force in Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Guam, American Samoa, and the Johnson Atoll.
What about Okinawa?
You know, Okinawa should be there because that's where a lot of the Agent Orange went through.
Right, yeah.
So, good Lord.
Man, maybe that's already included.
Maybe that is. So, but expand presumptions for radiation-exposed veterans at certain locations between certain years. Strengthen federal research on toxic exposure. Improve VA's resources and training for toxic-exposed veterans. And invest in VA claims processing, VA's workforce, and VA healthcare facilities. This is a wonderful bill when you look at it like that. Now, when they say the radiation, expand presumptions for radiation-exposed veterans at certain locations between certain years. That's the one I would ask, what are you talking about? But because they might be talking about, exposure during the Pacific, but most of those guys are long gone anyway. But anyway, that passed 84-14, and it went over to the House, and it came back with a minor adjustment. And all of a sudden, the Senate flipped 25 votes, meaning that this would now not pass,
Like from one day to the next?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
From one day to the next. The point is, right on the heels of our VA show, right on the heels of what we consider to be a victory with the ending of the Air Commission. The Republicans in the Senate do this. And so here in Tennessee, I called the our two traitorous senators, Marsha Blackburn and Bill Hagerty, and I let them both have it. Well, I let the staff have it.
Did they vote against it?
Hagerty flipped his vote. Marsha voted against it to begin with.
Wow.
Marsha voted against it to begin with, and Hagerty then flipped a yes to a no. And, you know,
what is their defense?
There's no defense. Well, Hagerty, the staff member says, well, he's got technical issues with it now. The House barely changed anything. And so he's got technical issues with it now. No, the rationale was, and this is what I'm seeing on Secular Talk, Humanist Report, and a variety of other progressive news, is that McConnell was upset that Schumer and Biden and Manchin had actually come up with a bill that would require reconciliation. And they kept it a secret, and then waited for this CHIP Act, which would bring chip manufacturing back to the United States, or, you know, at least initiate it. They were upset that they got snookered a little bit, that they decided, we're going to beat on veterans.
This was retaliation. Democrats. But right.
And the key here is, you and I have done our best to lay out the Democrats as far as inaction, as far as foreign policy stupidity. But we've never laid them out for cruelty, because that really is the environment of the Republicans. I mean, the Republicans just took rights away from women with regard to choosing how they want to have their reproductive future. And Tennessee just initiated the anti-abortion ban, and states all across the country, red states all across the country, are taking rights away from women. They've already taken voting rights away from people of color, and now they're going to take rights away from veterans. So if anybody doesn't think that they're not coming for you, they're coming for you. If you're not part of the white, rich elite, the Republicans are going to come for you.
That's a good, strong statement there. I think we should use that.
Yeah.
They're so coming for you.
Are you going to call Lindsey Graham?
Yeah, I'll call him. This is the burn pit issue that Biden was supposedly going to fight for.
Yeah, and he did, and he got it passed. And now the Republicans are betraying veterans. And, you know, here in Tennessee, I wrote to several of my acquaintances in BVA and AMVETS to say, are you going to get your folks to call out Marsha Blackburn and Bill Hagerty about their vote on this? Anyway, there's my rant. So, you know, let me just finish with this. If you're listening to this portion of the show, before we get to the next portion, if you're listening to this and you can push pause, I want you to pause it. And I want you to call your Republican senator. And if you don't have a Republican senator, well, God bless you there. You actually live in a state with some common sense. But if you don't have a Republican senator, then call the office of some Republican in another state and just call them out. Call them out, because that's a betrayal against every kid that's in the military and have been in the military. And, you know, and I'll just leave it there. Okay, so now that you're back, now that you've pressed play, after calling your senator and telling him about the PACT Act and calling him out, now that you're back, it's time for the meat of the show. This is the last show before August 6th and 9th, the anniversaries of the only time any country dropped atomic weapons on a population. Who were they, Harvey? Who was the only country to drop an atomic weapon on a population?
The U.S. of A.
The U.S. of A. Well, recently, Massachusetts Pete's Action conducted training on how to talk to people about the danger of nuclear weapons and nuclear war and the need to get them eliminated in accordance with the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And so with that, we wanted to talk about that training and maybe how you can use it. Did you watch it, Harvey?
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Part one, which was Ira Helfand, who has a great track record and has, you know, received a lot of honors being part of ICANN and also Physicians for Social Responsibility. So he's got a couple of Nobel Peace Prize on his resume. And I thought he gave a very good talk. And what the point of it was to look at what questions people would have in response to his presentation. Mm-hmm. And
what do you want to listen to the presentation?
That would be good.
So let me just begin. I want to thank you all for coming tonight. I need to talk to you about a difficult topic, which is nuclear war. And I appreciate your taking the time to be here with me tonight. I know you all understand in advance that this is not going to be an easy conversation. And I'm glad, though, that you're taking part in it. I think I usually apologize to people when I'm going to give a nuclear talk, because I am going to be bringing a lot of unpleasantness into your evening. But I think recently I've really come to the feeling that we only have two choices when it comes to nuclear war. We can talk about it and do something about it, or we can live through it at some point in the future, which will be even worse. So this is, in that sense, a necessary exercise. We have, for the last 30 years, been living in a state of deep denial about the nuclear danger. When the Cold War ended, we all started to act as though the danger of nuclear war had passed, as indeed it should have. But in fact, it didn't. the nuclear weapons didn't go away. There are still in the world today more than 13,000 nuclear warheads that are held by 9 countries. And they're listed here in order of the size of their, size of their arsenals. Russia, the United States, actually it should have France next, the United Kingdom, China, Pakistan, India, Israel, and North Korea. We have some understanding of what a nuclear war would look like. We've all seen images of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we have to understand, while these are powerful warnings to us about the terrible damage that nuclear weapons can cause, Hiroshima and Nagasaki do not begin to prepare us for what will happen if there's a nuclear war today. If the United States and Russia go to war, it's not going to be one relatively small 15 kiloton bomb on one or two cities. It's going to be many bombs on many cities, each of which will be anywhere from 10 to 50 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And so let me begin tonight by talking a little bit about what a large-scale attack using modern nuclear weapons would look like. I'm going to use a model involving the city of Boston. We don't know the exact targeting strategy that the Russians or the Americans or any of the other nuclear powers have. But experts tell us that a city like Boston is almost certainly targeted with something on the order of 10, maybe more nuclear warheads. Again, each of which is anywhere from 10 to as much as 50 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. In order to describe the destruction that that kind of an attack would cause, I'm going to use the model of a single, very large nuclear explosion, a 20 megaton bomb. We used to have 20 megaton weapons in the arsenals of the United States and the Soviet Union. We don't anymore. We use multiple smaller warheads. The megatonnage in this model is greater than what we would expect to hit Boston. The damage that I'm going to describe is actually less than would be caused by an attack using many smaller warheads, because you cause more damage if you use multiple explosions spread out over the entire metropolitan area. Within a thousandth of a second of the detonation of this bomb, a fireball would form, reaching out for 2 miles in every direction, 4 miles across. Within this area, temperatures would be hotter than the surface of the sun, and everything would be vaporized. The buildings, the trees, the upper level of the earth itself would disappear. To a distance of 4 miles in every direction, the explosion would generate winds greater than 600 miles per hour. To a distance of 6 miles in every direction, the heat would still be so intense that automobiles would melt. And to a distance of 16 miles in every direction, the heat would still be so intense that everything flammable would burn. Paper, cloth, gasoline, heating oil, plastic, wood, it would all ignite. Hundreds of thousands of fires, which over the next half hour would coalesce into a firestorm, 32 miles across, covering over 800 square miles. Within that entire area, the temperature would reach 1400 degrees Fahrenheit. All of the oxygen would be consumed, and every living thing would die. In the case of Boston, we're talking about something like 3 to 4 million people dead in a half an hour. In the case of a larger city like New York, 12 to 15 million people in every would be dead within a half an hour. And beyond the firestorm, beyond the zone of complete fatality, there would be all kinds of horrible injuries. Hundreds of thousands of patients with every imaginable type of traumatic injury, crush injuries from being trapped in falling buildings, collapsed lungs from the overpressures, deafness from perforated eardrums, blindness from retinal burning, and above all, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of patients with severe burns. There are in the United States only 2,000 burn beds in the entire country. And in the Boston area alone, there would be several hundred thousand people requiring that intense level of care, which would not be available, meaning that the vast, vast majority of these patients would not get medical attention that they needed. And most of them would die from their injuries. If this were part of a large-scale war involving the United States and Russia, this kind of devastation would occur at every major city in both countries. A study which we did back in 2002 showed that if just 300 of the 1,500 warheads in the Russian strategic arsenal got through to cities in the United States, 75 to 100 million people would die in the first half hour. And a similar number would die in Russia from the US counterattack. And if NATO was drawn into the conflict, this kind of destruction would take place in Europe and Canada as well. But as horrible as this is, it's only part of the story, because the entire economic infrastructure of the country would be destroyed. Nothing that we require to maintain our society would be left. There'd be no electric grid. There'd be no internet. There'd be no food distribution system. There'd be no banking system. There'd be no system to distribute fuel oil or gasoline. And in the months following this initial attack, the vast majority of people in both countries who did not die in the initial wave of attacks would also die from starvation, from radiation poisoning, from epidemic disease, from exposure. But again, even this is not the full story, because these direct effects in the countries that are attacked in the nuclear war are only part of what happens. There is a global impact on climate, which is even more catastrophic. The enormous fires caused in cities in both countries loft tremendous amounts of smoke, 150 million tons of black soot into the upper atmosphere, blocking out the sun and dropping temperatures across the entire planet, an average of 15 to 18 degrees Fahrenheit. In the interior regions of North America, as you can see on this map, temperatures drop to by anywhere from 30 to 35 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. These are temperatures significantly colder than the coldest part of the last ice age. And these conditions, which would occur very rapidly, they would develop over a matter of days, would persist for more than a decade. And under these conditions, all of the ecosystems which have evolved since the end of the last ice age would collapse. Food production would stop, and the vast majority of the human race would starve to death. It is possible we would become extinct as a species. In recent years, we have learned that it is not just a large-scale war between the United States and Russia that we need to worry about as a threat to the entire planet. A nuclear war in South Asia between smaller nuclear powers, India and Pakistan, would also have worldwide consequences. Just 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs dropped on the major cities of these two countries would kill 20 million people promptly, contaminate vast areas of South Asia with radioactive fallout, and put enough soot into the upper atmosphere to cause some significant global climate disruption. Not as bad as with a large war between the US and Russia, but quite catastrophic anyway. This graph shows the drop in temperature that would follow a limited war between India and Pakistan. The blue line shows all of the global warming which has taken place since 1880 and which has been such a cause of concern to all of us. The red line shows what happens in a matter of days following this war. Temperatures drop 1.3 degrees centigrade. In the interior regions of North America and Eurasia, the temperature drop is more marked. And as a result of this, there's a tremendous decrease in food production. I'm not going to go through the details here. We can come back to that later in the question period if people want to. But suffice it to say that there is a significant decline in food production, major crops, major staple crops that people depend on. And as a result of that, we experience a global famine. And we're not in a position at this point in time to deal with that kind of a situation. At the beginning of last year, when I checked the data last, a global food reserves were only enough to feed the planet for about 107 days. Moreover, there are at baseline today huge numbers of people who are malnourished. It was 690 million people last year. Because of the economic dislocation that has taken place over the period of the pandemic and since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that number has now gone up to over 800 million people again. There are, in addition, hundreds of millions of people who live in countries where food production is pretty good, where economic circumstances are pretty good. Food consumption today is quite adequate, but much of the food is imported. And in the conditions that would follow this kind of disruption, food imports wouldn't be available to them either. There are also about 1 billion people in China who live in a country where most of the food is grown in country, where today food consumption is adequate, but where over 1 billion people live in significant poverty. And under the conditions which would arise following a limited nuclear war, they too would have difficulty putting food on their table. And so we have come to conclude that this very limited scenario could cause up to 2 billion people to be at risk for starvation. Now, that data has stood for the last decade. A study is going to be released in the next month, which will upgrade our estimates given the fact that the arsenals in India and Pakistan have grown dramatically since our studies were first done. The size of the weapons has grown dramatically, and the population of the cities which will be attacked has grown dramatically. And the scenario which will be discussed in this new publication considers not 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs, but 250 weapons, ranging in size up to 100 kilotons, which is about six times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. This would cause not 25 million people dead promptly, but 50 to 120 million dead, and would cause a much greater disturbance of climate and a much greater decline in food production. That's the situation that we face today. We are living in a world which can be destroyed in a moment's notice by nuclear weapons, which are in the hands of nine people, the leaders of nine countries. And we have to understand that what I've described is not some kind of an abstract horror story, like the plot for a grade B movie. Even if no one makes a deliberate decision to launch a war, there is always the danger that we will go to war by accident. This screen shows 6 days during the nuclear weapons era. On these dates, either Moscow or Washington began the process of launching their nuclear arsenals, each time in the mistaken belief that they were under attack by the other side.
And I'll give you those dates. May 23rd, 1967. I was just about ready to graduate from high school, Harvey. Mm-hmm. And you were already in the Navy.
That's right.
That's right. So then November 9th, 1979, June 3rd, 1980, September 26th, 1983, November 7th, 1983. 1983 was a tough year. And January 25th, 1995. And the chart does not show who made the accident, but these were dates when we misread what was going on the other side and took steps to start the nuclear process.
And that doesn't even include the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962.
Exactly.
Where we came so close.
Yes.
So McNamara close. Says it was just luck that we didn't end the world right then.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the danger of an accidental nuclear war is with us continuously. As Robert McNamara observed, we are not here today because we had wise leaders or sound doctrine or infallible technology. We're here today because, and I'm quoting him, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. And we have to understand that our current situation is really nothing more than a hope for continued good luck. We are also in a situation when the danger of a deliberate war is growing daily. With the invasion of Ukraine and the repeated Russian threats to use nuclear weapons and NATO's counter threats to retaliate with nuclear weapons, we can no longer deny the reality that a major nuclear war launched as a deliberate policy decision is something which confronts us and which we cannot dismiss. And it's not just the United States and Russia. Tensions between the United States and China are the worst they've been in decades. Situation in South Asia that we were talking about just a minute ago remains tense. India and Pakistan almost went to war twice in 2019, and the underlying issues have not been resolved. The situation with North Korea remains very unstable. In addition, we have to understand the role that climate change is playing. Because many people in the leadership of nuclear weapon states tell us all the time, they want to get rid of nuclear weapons too, but they just, we can't do it now because the world is too dangerous. But in the future, when the world is safer, we'll get rid of our nuclear weapons. The problem is that the climate crisis is making the world a more dangerous place. And as the climate crisis unfolds over coming decades, and it will do that, even if we do all the things that we're supposed to do now to try to limit the damage, parts of the world are going to get increasingly inhospitable. It will be harder and harder for many countries to support their population. And as that process unfolds, there'll be increased pressure, increased tendency for conflict within countries as people fight for scarce resources. There'll be forced migration on a scale we have never seen before. And the chance of war between countries will grow. And if nuclear weapons are on the table, as this process unfolds, the chance that they will be used will also grow. The place where this process is most acute is in South Asia. This map shows the Indus River in blue, which both India and Pakistan depend on, hundreds of millions of people on both sides of the border. This river is going to dry up in coming decades as the Himalayan glaciers which feed it melt. There'll initially be some increased flow of water in the river, and then as the glaciers are depleted, the flow of water will decrease. At the same time, the population is growing. And India and Pakistan do not have a plan at this point for how to deal with this water crisis. It will lead to increased tension between them as they grapple with how on each side to get the largest share of the available water. So this is a very grim future that we're facing. And you could ask, why bother even to talk about this? And there's an important reason, because this is not the future that must be. It is the future that will be if we don't act. But we can act. Nuclear weapons are not a problem that is beyond our control. They're not a force of nature. It's not as though an asteroid is coming at the planet and there's nothing we can do about it. These are little machines that we have built with our own hands, and we know how to take them apart. And we need to do that. And fortunately, there is a movement growing around the world to deal with this problem. Internationally, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, working with a number of key governments, launched a process about a decade ago to create a new treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And in just a few short years, that treaty was adopted by the United Nations in July of 2017. The vote at the UN was 122-1. The treaty has now been ratified by 65 countries and has entered legally into force and has really changed the international landscape and the international discussion about nuclear weapons. Here in the United States, we've launched the Back from the Brink campaign to bring the pressure generated by the TPNW to bear on our government. It calls primarily for the United States to begin negotiations now with the other 8 nuclear armed states for a verifiable, enforceable, time-bound agreement to eliminate the remaining nuclear weapons. And it has spread rapidly. It's been endorsed at this point by over 400 organizations in civil society, by 300 local elected officials, by 60 cities and towns, by 7 state legislative bodies, and it is growing all the time. We have to understand that it is within our power to change the world. It is a huge task and a huge responsibility. But with that responsibility comes an extraordinary opportunity. Every one of us has children, grandchildren, relatives, friends who we cherish. We want them to survive. We want them to have the life that they deserve. We have the ability to give them this. We have the ability to save the world. And that, in some sense, is a very precious gift. There's nothing better that any of us can ever do with our life than save the world. And so I hope that we will all take on this information with that spirit in mind. A tremendous challenge lies ahead of us. We face a grave danger. We can make the difference. We can choose life, and our children and grandchildren can live. Thank you. So, again, you know, that's a version of the talk that I often give.
A lot there, Harvey.
Yes.
And, you know, and this
is pro-life, I'd say.
Yeah, pro-life. Bring that to the Republican table. Life. That's right. So, I mean, the purpose of this talk was to give it to people who might be giving talks. So if you're going to give a presentation, it's something where you need to look this up. If you're talking to folks on the street or folks in a conversation or whatever type of gatherings you might have, and it turns towards the war in Ukraine or whatever, you can say, well, I'm worried about nuclear weapons, and we need nuclear disarmament, and be ready by just looking at all the information that Ira Heflin has given. And you can find this on YouTube by just searching nuclear disarmament speaker training. That's where it comes from. But, you know, there's so much there. If you're just talking to neighbors or whatever, you need to pick something out that you can say.
Yeah.
And then be ready to discuss. But
right. The other side is how you respond to people's reactions.
Exactly. And they did do a little bit of that training.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see if I can find out the first question that you might run into.
First question. People ask this all the time. As soon as you finish your talk, somebody says, yeah, but what about the North Koreans or the Iranians? Somebody like to answer that.
So that was a question that he started with as far mm-hmm. as if you're given a presentation,
mm-hmm.
What about the North Koreans and the Iranians? So, Harvey, how would you answer that?
Well, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons has talks about negotiations between nuclear countries to and verifiable ways to assure that all parties are in fact disarming. So I mean, there is would be strong inspection requirements. We have the technology now to detect any active development of nuclear weapons. So, of course, Iran does not have a nuclear weapon, so they're not a nuclear party. They've signed the non-proliferation treaty, in fact. So I don't think they would be that much of an issue. I'm sure they would love to see a world without nuclear weapons, since they don't have one either. North Korea, you know, a lot of the problems that we have to deal with are consequences of our own actions. For instance, what Kim Jong-un has said is, I saw what happened to Muammar Gaddafi when he gave up his nuclear weapons. You invaded his country and killed him. So, you know, we're our own worst enemy when it comes to trying to establish trust with North Korea, which is, a leader who's quite unstable to begin with. That's the case whenever you bring this up, it's always fine, but you know, the Russians aren't going to do that, or fine, but the Chinese aren't going to do that. But the treaty contains the mechanisms and also a time, you know, a significant time frame for these nations to negotiate how it's going to be done. And there's even a House resolution to begin those negotiations as soon as possible. And there's nothing stopping us from trying to negotiate that.
Exactly. But what about if we sign on the treaty and the Russians and the Chinese decide not to?
Well, that's where the nuclear states have to participate as a group. And they all have the same things they have to consider. And there's not going to be, you know, Russia's not going to sign the treaty. And if the U.S. isn't going to sign the treaty, I mean.
I think you hit it right there because, you know.
The nuclear states are a separate issue, and they have to. Yeah. They are the problem, and they need to get their heads together to solve the problem.
Yeah, and I think we had a guest on, and I forget, our friend from the socialist program. Doggone, forget his name right now.
Brian Becker.
Brian Becker, who related the case of all of these folks who now have nuclear weapons were in response to something the United States did.
Yes, the entire, and that same case was made by James Carroll.
Yeah.
He spoke. Look at the history of nuclear proliferation, nuclear arsenals. It's always the U.S. who takes the first step, and other countries then respond to that.
So
it's consistent.
So if history is consistent, if the United States takes the first step, I am guessing, based historically, and people might think I'm naive, but if we take the first step, I believe Russia and China would be anxious to eliminate their nuclear weapons. If we eliminated ours, I think Russia and China would be anxious.
And we have an obligation to take leadership. We're the country that has used this bomb on human beings.
Yeah. And so with that, the countries in Europe, France and Britain and et cetera, I think they jump on it too. United States leads that. So there you have it. The those major countries with the major amount of nuclear weapons would probably jump on this thing if the United States would lead the way. That would leave only outliers like North Korea and our friends Israel. And
yeah, Israel would probably be a tougher cookie to deal with than North Korea.
Yeah. Even though and I'm sure their idea about wanting to have nuclear weapons is to defend himself against Iran, even though Iran, in my opinion, historically and currently, they're no threat to Israel. They're no threat to Israel. Israel's the threat in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So, and then North Korea, I'm pretty sure that if we would end our nuclear threat, if we would end our sanctions against North Korea, I'm pretty sure they would go along. I mean, the expenditure of money and human resources to maintain, to create and maintain nuclear weapons is a drain.
Yes. Well, I think a big part of the problem they talked about a little bit was, or some of the other presentations talked about, was how the people of the U.S. and perhaps to some extent in other nuclear nations are oblivious to the threat that these weapons pose just by their existence.
Yeah. That's why it's important to anybody listening here that when you're going to a party, either over Labor Day or, you know, upcoming holidays, whenever, and you get into a discussion about Ukraine, about what we should be doing about Ukraine, turn it on its head. Turn it about nuclear weapons.
Well, you can connect the two because you
bet.
You know, this is a war that's relentlessly being escalated by more and more advanced weaponry being sent to Ukraine with the stated objective of weakening Russia to the point where they don't have any ability to match what Ukraine has because of all the billions of weapons being sent there.
Yeah.
But then that begs the question, Russian nuclear doctrine, if they see a horrendous defeat and that emboldened NATO poses a threat, and they feel that this is existential. And they always said, even Putin back in 2008 just said, Ukraine, we cannot allow Ukraine to be part of a military alliance with the United States on our border. Mm-hmm. It's unacceptable. We would have no security with that, and we will do whatever we have to do to prevent it. So, and the media has been so irresponsible. But, you hear these commentators just being so cavalier about, well, what if Russia used a tactical nuclear weapon? Well, yeah, they might do that, but it would be small. Not to worry. Right? It would be small.
A small one that would just take out the capital, Kyiv.
Who knows? But I mean, what do you call small? Anything under 100 kilotons is considered small, and Hiroshima mm-hmm. was 15 kilotons. So, but what I thought about again when we were talking about this show was our show we did last spring, and it was based on a webinar, an excellent webinar, which talked about the impossibility, the demonstrated impossibility of controlling escalation once the nuclear threshold has been crossed.
Exactly.
Once a nuclear weapon has been used. And this is based on our annual nuclear war games mm-hmm. called Global Thunder, and we do it every year. And we found a statement by General John Hyten, who was the commander of the U.S. Strategic Command at the time, talking about these exercises. And I had given up trying to find out anything about them, because if you Google Global Thunder, you will see every year the Pentagon's PR statement, and that's all you see. There's no independent analysis or investigation of these exercises and what they in fact showed. They're just all this glowing language about all these tens of thousands of people who participate and all our allies and how wonderful it is and how it shows how we can, how we will, what we will have to do to deter nuclear attack or to be successful if there is a strategic conflict. Strategic is the Pentagon euphemism for nuclear. Anytime you see strategic, that's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So anyway, John Hyten gave an address to the Arms Control Association 2018, not too long after one of their annual Global Thunder exercises. And what he said is that you cannot prevent escalation once you have nuclear weapon that has been used. And he said, we've tried, every year, we've run all these war games and simulations, and he said, and it ends the same way every time. It ends bad. And he said, and he's talking to these arms control people, he said, and by bad, I mean, it ends with global nuclear war. Every time.
There is going to be no adults in the room, depending on.
Because you just can't.
No.
You can't know enough to make decisions based on any knowledge of what's actually happening at the time.
Yeah. And say Russia uses a tactical, a small one, just any type of tactical nuclear weapon. because it feels like it's in a corner or it's in a box.
Yeah, and that's their nuclear doctrine. They have as much as said so. If they,
right.
they will not do first use unless their the survival of their country was under existential threat.
And so
they see this as existential.
Sure.
And they do what they call escalate to de-escalate.
Escalate to de-escalate. The problem is, who's going to de-escalate? Because you know the war hawks, there might be 90% of the American public who is say, don't do it. But there'd be just enough war hawks in the Pentagon to say, we have to respond with a nuclear weapon. Maybe even the same size, just a small one.
Yeah. But then what does Russia do?
Yeah. Then
what's
they the next step? Escalate.
And then
escalate.
What's the next step? And then what's the next step?
That's right. Because you've got enough people that are channeling Curtis LeMay to say, bomb them back to the Stone Age. Right. It would not stop.
But it's been exhaustively gamed.
Sure.
In these global thunder exercises year after year after year. And you know, you have to take the word of the supreme commander of this U.S. nuclear command, so-called strategic command, who should know if not him.
Yeah.
But you'll never see anything in the media about what he said.
Oh, no.
Every year you will not see anything in the media looking at this exercise or asking anyone in the Pentagon what they learned. Yeah, I did hear that Trump said the other day, said Biden is walking us into World War III. Did you see that?
Trump said that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it takes somebody like that to utter the blatant truth. He has no guardrails.
I know.
He has no filter. And that can be a good thing.
That's right. And the thing is,
there are some norms that need to be destroyed.
Exactly. And, you know, a number of people have said to me, because I've been ranting and raving about Biden, but a number of people have said to me, come on, he's so much better than what we had before. And I'm thinking, geez. Blinken and Austin saber rattling with regard to China, Austin coming out, we want to weaken Russia, Blinken and Austin filling up the tanks of Ukraine to keep the war going, to keep the war going so that more kids, more grandparents, more moms.
What would they have done when Iran attacked that U.S. base in Iraq after the assassination of their general? What would Blinken and Austin?
Oh, I know. Yeah. So, you know, domestically, the Republicans are horrific. With regard to veterans, the Republicans are horrific. But, you know, in this case, I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm thinking.
The right is making a lot more sense when it comes to Ukraine than the left is right now.
Exactly.
What
they call the left. Now what? We need a song.
Yeah, I was trying to think. Well, Talking World War III is good. Bob Dylan. Talking World War III.
Talking World War III. Let's see. That's perfect.
Everybody's having them dreams. I'm having them.
I know. Yep.
Oh, that's a long song, though. I hope we can have time to get it in.
Oh, I'll figure it out.
It's a great punchline.
Yep.
A crazy dream came to me. I dreamt I was walking in World War III. I went to the doctor the very next day to see what kind of words he had to say. He said it was a bad dream. laid hold of Doc, a world war passed my brain. He said, "Nurse, get your pad, the boy's insane." He took my arm as I said, "Ouch," as I landed hard on the psychiatric couch. He said, "Tell me about it." Well, the whole thing started at 3 o'clock fast. It was all over by 1:15. I was down in the sewer with some little lover when I peeked out from a manhole cover. Wonder who turned the lights on us. Well, I got up and I walked around, up and down the lonesome town. Just wondering which way to go. I lit a cigarette on a parking meter and walked on down the road. It was a normal day. Well, I rung the fallout shelter bell and I leaned my head and I gave a big yell. Give me a string bean, I'm a hungry man. A shotgun fired and away I ran. I don't blame him much, though he didn't know me. Down the corner, I seen another man turning around by the hot dog stand. I said, "Howdy, friend, I guess it's just us two." He screamed a bit and away he flew. He thought I was a communist. Spied me a girl, and before she could leave, I said, "Let's go play Adam and Eve." I took her by the hand, and my heart was thumping. She said, "Hey, man, you crazy or something? You seen what happened last time they started?" Well, I spied me a Cadillac window uptown, and I saw a Cadillac with nobody around. I got into the driver's seat and I drove down 42nd Street in my Cadillac. Good car to drive after a war. Well, I remember seeing some newspaper ads, so I turned on Conrad. But I didn't pay the Con Ed bell, so the radio didn't work so well. So I turned on the record player. It was Fabian singing, "Tell your ma, tell your pa, our love's gonna grow, ooh-wah, ooh-wah." I was feeling kind of lonesome and blue and needed somebody to talk to. So I called up the operator at time just to hear a voice of some kind. When you hear the beep, it will be 3 o'clock. She said that for over an hour and I hung up. Well, the doctor interrupted me just about then, saying I've been having the same old dreams. My mind's a little different, you see. I dreamt the only person left after the war was me. I didn't see you around. Well, now time passed and it seems everybody's having them dreams. Everybody sees herself walking around with nobody else. Well, all the people can be half right part of the time. Part of the people can be some right all of the time. But all the people can't be all right all of the time. Abraham Lincoln said that. "I'll let you be in my dream if I can be in yours." I said that.